Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, and I'm joined this week by my friend Alicia Heyman of Friends of the Eel River.
Hey, Tom.
Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center.
Hello, Tom.
And Jen Colt of Humble Baykeeper.
Hey there.
Hey, everyone. So we have a little bit of an eclectic show, a couple of different pieces moving on today. But Alicia, I know that you were down south recently to commemorate the opening of the first chunk of the Great Redwood Trail. So let's start off with, what is the Great Redwood Trail?
Yeah, well, to give people a little bit of background, starting way back about a decade ago, Friends of the Eel River for a little over 7 years was engaged in litigation with the North Coast Railroad Authority. Essentially, they wanted to rebuild the rail line. They didn't want to comply with CEQA. We thought that was wrong.
And this is the historic rail line that ran along the Eel River that was closed because it was unprofitable given the total huge amount of upkeep to keep it
exactly
working.
Yeah, at one point it was the most expensive rail line in the nation to maintain because constant landslides, you know, it's a really geologically fragile area.
And tunnels that they had to send somebody walking through the tunnel ahead of the train.
Yeah, scary job, definitely. So eventually in 2017, the California Supreme Court agreed with us that yes, CEQA does apply in whatever the North Coast Railroad Authority wanted to do there. So shortly following our victory, Senator Mike McGuire introduced legislation that would dismantle the North Coast Railroad Authority, rail bank the line, which preserves the right-of-way for future transportation, and eventually establish a 320-mile multi-use trail in its place. The vision for this trail is that it would connect Humboldt Bay to San Francisco Bay and be, you know, kind of like a world-class trail destination for hikers, bikers, equestrian use. Pretty exciting thing. So that got off to a pretty good start. It passed in 2018 with really broad support. And in 2019, legislators spent the year settling out the debts of the North Coast Railroad Authority and, you know, just kind of preparing for this shift. So fast forward to just a couple weeks ago, I was down in Ukiah, where they opened the first segment of the trail that is officially branded as the Great Redwood Trail. Now, to be clear, there are sections of the trail that are technically already done in a variety of communities. Ukiah already had some. Up here in Humboldt, we technically have parts of the Great Redwood Trail because that same rail line that they're going to be eventually turning into a trail by putting the trail on top of the existing rail is the Humboldt Bay Trail. So that's that same rail line, but because we got started earlier, that's a rail alongside trail project.
And so eventually Hammond Trail up in McKinleyville is going to connect to the Bay Trail, which will connect to the Great Redwood Trail, and it will all be of one trail entity.
All one trail
yes,
together.
Yes, in fact, it's all part of the California Coastal Trail, which has been planned since, I think, the 1980s by the California Coastal Commission. So there's been a planning effort to build the California Coastal Trail in sections in all these different jurisdictions, and eventually that trail will connect from the Oregon border all the way to Mexico. The Fort Bragg area has gotten over 20 miles of California Coastal Trail completed in the last, I don't know, 5 or so years. And it's incredible. If you haven't been down to Fort Bragg since the Georgia Pacific Mill shut down and the trail was built, it's amazing, just incredible coastline there. But yeah, so the Hammond Trail will eventually connect up to what in the north? I don't know. Trinidad, and then keep going, hopefully.
And so we'll be able to get on in McKinleyville and ride south. How far south will we be able to ride on the trail once construction is complete?
Yeah, so the Great Redwood Trail section is eventually going to just continue along the rail line. So if you would follow the line, you know, it goes south through Eureka, through Lolita. Eventually, somewhere around Dyersville, it crosses the river, and then it's on the, what is that, the east side of the river, and then it follows the main stem of the Eel River all the way down to about Willits, where it then turns inland again, and then it's alongside the 101, essentially.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. To ride along the main stem of the Eel on your bike is just going to be a fantastic adventure.
Well, and it's incredibly difficult to access that area. You know, as it is, you're either rafting for days to get there, or, you know, you're one of the fortunate few who has a helicopter. So it's a really remote area to access and super excited about the potential. And so Senator Mike McGuire said that in the next year, we should expect to see a master plan come out for the trail and to see that rail banking activity actually begin. So we're really looking forward to the momentum getting going on this.
It's so exciting. I mean, it's a dream come true that a lot of people thought would never really happen, all this trail building.
Yeah.
After, you know, the last train ran on the tracks up here, well, north of Willits, I guess, in, I think, was it 1997? And then it was shut down due to an emergency, you know, because of all the crazy storm damage and stuff. And, you know, then there have been people who've kept the train dream alive for all these years and would block our forward momentum on the trails. But it's really great that we're finally moving forward and it's all happening pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And to bring up the Coastal Commission again, we have the California Coastal Commission to thank for the Bay Trail, because in 2013, the 101 Corridor Safety Project decision, the Coastal Commission required that Caltrans plan and fund the Bay Trail and remove a bunch of billboards which are in the way of the Bay Trail. So,
and the Bay Trail is a rail next to trail instead of a rail to trail, because we have such odious rail fans up here, choo-choo heads.
Yeah, well,
it's kind of because it happened. The Bay Trail got built, except for the 4-mile section in the county's jurisdiction, before the Great Redwood Trail Agency was formed. And so it was that or nothing at that time.
And we were fortunate enough to come up with a huge chunk of extra money to do that. Building a rail with trail is a lot more expensive than doing rail to trail. So we're really lucky that we're at the point we are now.
So I wanted to inject, Tom, that I actually had the amazing experience of riding the rail. My buddy and I hopped the train in Eureka, and I rode on a flat car through the Eel River Valley in 1976 or something. Froze my butt off, but it was awesome. So I can tell you that riding your bike, if the trail follows the old tracks at all, it's a pretty amazing, and it's a view of the Eel River that you never see.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. I've been down there for rare plant surveys on sections of the rail that were going to be removed to restore fish passage, and it's just stunning.
Do you remember, I think it was about a year ago, that there was a trespass grow on the old rail bed site that was busted?
There was, yeah. I want to say it was maybe around Dos Rios, maybe around Spy Rock, something like that.
No.
Yeah, it was somewhere in between there. Yeah.
It was totally just the silliest thing, because I think that they used the rail tracks as kind of part of this like mini greenhouse that they constructed. We'll put a link to that in the show notes online. It was really cool to see. And not that I like trespass grows, but like
it was very creative.
Yeah, ingenuity. Yeah. Like I have to give some respect for that, or maybe I don't.
Well, and speaking of trespassing, if you're ready to talk about billboard situation.
Let's talk about billboards.
You know, in the last, I think, 7 years or 5 years or so, since the 2013 Coastal Commission decision, really, and a little bit before, we've seen, I think, about 18 billboards removed from the 101 corridor between Arcata and Eureka. And many of those were trespass billboards that were on public lands, part of which were the North Coast Rail Authority property or easement. And the billboard companies were just not even paying anybody for having their signs on public lands. And so most of those billboards have been removed. Now there's four left in between Arcata and Eureka, or actually three, because one of them's been soaking in the bay since November 27th when it fell down. But so the Harbor District, Humboldt Bay Harbor Recreation and Conservation District, voted recently to ban new and existing billboards in their jurisdiction, which is from the high water line out into the bay. And so there's, you know, some argument over that to be conducted in the future, but generally it would look like that billboard's going to be gone soon, as well as the other three in that area. But this Thursday, February 20th, the Planning Commission of Humboldt County is scheduled to consider a special permit to rebuild the billboard that fell into the Elk River wetlands south of Eureka, also, I think, on November 27th. So billboard law is all very complicated. Caltrans is actually the agency that permits most of the billboards through something called the Outdoor Advertising Agency, which for some ridiculous reason is called the ODA. I don't know where that comes from. But so the ODA permits the billboards over and over every year. They just issue them a new permit. And even if they are in wetlands or the floodplain, which the law itself that covers billboards doesn't allow, they just keep renewing the permits. And so it's been a long battle that actually way precedes Humboldt Baykeeper. I mean, there's been people around here been fighting billboards for decades. And so on February 20th, there's going to be a chance for people to come out to a public hearing and tell the Planning Commission what they think about issuing a special permit to rebuild the billboard in the wetlands on agricultural zoned land. They're not allowed in the county unless they're on commercial or industrial land, but it's going to be really interesting, you know, to see the crazy twisted pretzel the county puts itself in to try and see if this can even be approved. So come on out to the hearing and tell them what you think about billboards. We'll send out an action alert and post it on the Baykeeper website and everything, too. So,
does the county have any kind of incentive for approving permits like this? Like, why?
No.
Why would they be interested in that?
Because we need to be open for business here in Humboldt County, right?
I mean, the real interest is to avoid getting sued by the billboard companies. That's what most people cite. You know, their billboard law is a very peculiar and convoluted branch of public
First Amendment
free speech.
Yeah.
So, like, there's free speech laws that protect all kinds of things, right? But you notice political signs, you're not allowed to put up political signs except, what, 30 days before an election or something like that. Billboard law, it's just crazy, so convoluted. And a lot of the billboards predate any kind of zoning or permitting. And so they skirt around these rules that have been placed on them.
And the one you're talking about, I remember when it went up, Jim Hoff owned that property and that billboard, and there was a lot of blowback against that billboard going up, surprisingly, at the time. But because of all the things you just said, he was just able to put it up, and nobody could do anything about it. The county didn't want to touch it, so.
Well, and really interestingly, the city of Arcata refused to permit a billboard some years ago that got knocked down in a storm, I think, and got sued by Viacom, it was at the time. You know, these corporations, they just keep on changing hands. And now it is Outfront Media. It's the name of the billboard company. But so Viacom sued the city of Arcata, and the city of Arcata appealed and won. And so they got, you know, published case law that, yes, a local jurisdiction can refuse to permit a billboard if it doesn't conform with the local zoning, even if it predates zoning. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens. There's so many different twists and turns to all of this. And Baykeeper's been working with our attorney, who has gotten, you know, totally fascinated by going down the rabbit hole on billboard law, which most people do. But, you know, do they belong on wetlands? No, they're not allowed in the floodplain for safety reasons. Of course not. You know, this one is probably too close to the highway. It doesn't meet any of the standards other than the company that owns the property, you know, calls it their private property rights to have these billboards there. So.
And I remember the other issue at the time was that billboards were supposed to be a certain size, and this one was way bigger than all the other billboards.
Yeah, this one that fell down south of Eureka is much bigger than it was originally permitted for also. But, you know, like I said, yeah, there's a huge rabbit hole to go down with all these things and trying to figure out what's legal and what predates all the new restrictions that have been put on the billboards.
Well, thankfully, at least we've had enough changeover in the last couple years on the Planning Commission that just invoking private property rights isn't itself a trump card that will win the day. So, you know, I think, Jen, you might have a fighting chance these days before our Planning Commission.
So we'll that's see. February 20th, there Thursday, we go. February 20th in the evening, 6 o'clock at the County Supervisor's Chambers, the torture chamber, I call it. And you can send in letters in advance, emails in advance, that sort of thing. And so we'll Baykeeper will have all the information for people to be able to participate, whether you can show up or just send in a letter in advance. And you can always watch it on TV or live in the archives. It should be entertaining.
All right. Well, so sign up for Humble Baykeeper's email blast at
alerts@humblebaykeeper.org.
There we go. All right.
Or you can like us on Facebook. There will be plenty of traffic on this on Facebook as well.
And we're the Eco News Report. Back to our roundtable discussion of local environmental news. All right. So now to you, Larry. I know that you are neck deep in a Forest Service project.
Yeah, Six Rivers Hazardous Fuels and Fire Management Project. It started its scoping back on December 20th. Comments are due by February 18th. And it's a Six Rivers National Forest-wide project. And Kimberly Baker, who works with you at EPIC, and I have been looking at this. We went to the Forest Service's Dog and Pony Show at the supervisor's office back on the 15th and listened to the whole spiel about it. We don't really have a problem with what they're proposing as far as what they want to do on the ground.
Well, so what do they want to do on the ground?
Well, it involves reintroducing fire,
which is a good forest thing.
Which is a good thing. It involves removing hazardous fuels right along the roadways, which most of us are supporting. So the things that it wants to accomplish, and these are small diameter trees, by the way, that they're talking about removing along the and brush along the highways. So most of the things that this sets out to do are all things that we support. Where the problem comes in is that they want to do this big forest-wide project under a CE, which is a categorical exclusion, which is the least amount of investigation and scrutiny that a government agency puts on a project.
Right. So I think folks are generally familiar with the idea of an environmental impact statement, and that is kind of full-blown NEPA, we might call it, National Environmental Policy Act. And that's where we really get into the nitty-gritty and study the impacts of a project.
And up until just recently, it would just have been standard operating procedure to do a full EIS on a project of this scope. In the last 8 to 10 years, we've been seeing them try and get away with EAs, just an environmental assessment.
Which are kind of like a mini EIS. You take a look at things, but it's not really in the depth of an EIS. So EIS, we're thinking hundreds of pages. EA is 50 pages, maybe.
Well, and lately, because we've challenged, you and me have challenged so many of these, they've actually expanded EAs to where they really are just junior EISs now. They have to incorporate so much. So that's what Kimberly and I are kind of have been pushing for, is for them to do an EA on this project. And then they need to do site-specific analysis of each of the areas in the different parts of Six Rivers that they want to treat.
Yeah, so they're thinking entire Six Rivers National Forest, however hundreds of thousands of acres.
Right. And the conditions in Gasky are not the same as they are by Willow Creek or by, you know, Mad River. You know, they're very different circumstances.
Yeah, we might have a wetland over in Gasky, and in Willow Creek, it might be dry and beautiful and easy to log, flat, you know, all of the things that we kind of are looking
for. Exactly.
Well, we've been hoisted by our own petard, it sounds like, by being too effective.
So anyways, comments are due by February 18th. You can go and find the details of this project on the Forest Service's website at Six Rivers National Forest and look under projects, and you'll find this one.
And when we are done with our comments for EPIC and the NEC, I'm sure that we'll both post them on our website and make them available for people to check out. And this is just such an interesting project because it's a bit of a process issue as opposed to actually being opposed to the underlying treatments or theoretically opposed to the underlying treatments.
Exactly. This is them doing what we've been bugging them to do for a long time. They're just not doing it the right way. in our opinion.
Well, and to go beyond the process issue, as a botanist, you know, I just think of all the rare plants that are really just very limited to roadsides nowadays. There's quite a few species like that, and one well-meaning but uninformed road worker with a grader can just take out an entire rare plant population, and it has been done repeatedly. And so it doesn't take much to avoid those, but if you don't know they're there because you haven't assessed the potential for them and exactly. surveyed the area, then you're just willy-nilly destroying biodiversity without even realizing it.
That's what doing a site-specific assessment will give us, that knowledge. What water courses are along that stretch of the road, what rare plants, what endangered species might be right along that stretch of the road. Then we can tailor the act. Doesn't mean the activity doesn't happen. It just means we have to alter what goes on. I think so far that the Forest Service seems to be receptive to what Kimberly and I have been saying to them.
And Six Rivers National Forest. Each national forest has its own culture, has its own kind of norms and ethoses. Six Rivers, ever since we got Merv George on board, he's since left, but it seems like they operate under a different playbook, which is more inclusive, more open, more transparent, and more environmentally friendly.
Yeah, they call themselves the collaborative forest. They want to work with the public.
Unlike Klamath National Forest.
Or Shasta Trinity.
Yeah, or now, unfortunately, Mendocino, since we've had to file a number of lawsuits down there. All right. Well, thanks, Larry. What date again is the...
February 18th. The comments have to be... These are scoping comments. So they're basically whatever you look at the project and what did you think that they left out? What did they think should be included? Or do you really like it? Let them know what you think.
All right, and you can find more information under the projects page at Six Rivers National Forest website. And again, I will try to put a link in the description for the show. Okay, well, I have something that I thought was pretty funny. And this is our WTF moment of the week, which is this. The state of California is looking at how it can achieve what are called negative carbon emissions. That is, can we do things that actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere in net? And so they hired the Lawrence Livermore Labs to help study these ideas. And one that the Lawrence Livermore National Labs has come forward with is a real doozy of an idea. And by doozy, I don't mean that in a very complimentary way, which is this. They propose establishing new biomass facilities across the state, particularly in the Sierras, taking a lot of those dead, dying trees that were killed a number of years ago in the Sierras, burning them, and then creating pipelines from the biomass facilities to the Central Valley, where the CO2 and the gases emitted when they're burnt can be shipped and then stored safely underground.
So safely, I would
So
imagine.
Safely, right? What could possibly go wrong with such a plan?
And what is Lawrence Livermore famous for, Tom?
Oh, I don't know. What is it famous for?
I think a lot of nuclear stuff that went sideways came from that lab.
Oh, womp
yeah,
womp.
I went to a couple of protests there when I was a teenager.
There
Lawrence
we go.
Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. It sounds like a problem on every level. Like, why not just leave the woody material sitting on the top of the soil. I don't know. Let it break down and become part of the...
Chip it and incorporate
carbon
it into
cycle
the...
in the normal way.
Yeah, right. Well, that's not too high tech enough. And, you know, we need to figure out ways to really play with our climate even more through stuff like this.
Well, yeah, this is the 21st century. Imagine all the things we can do.
And part of it is the fire hysteria that has grown up, particularly in the Sierras. And so they're just looking for any technological solution to deal with, you know, making them feel less afraid. But they live in a forest, and that forest is drying out due to climate change. And that's the way life is going to be.
It's interesting when you think about this whole, what is it, the million, billion, trillion tree planting campaign, because, you know, in a lot of places, that's the last thing we need is more trees. But it seems to have gained a lot of traction. I don't know. It seems like...
Well, it works where they've deforested. Those are the places that need to get trees planted again, the places that used to support trees, and then they were just cleared away. But you're right, we don't need any more trees here in Northwest California. We've got enough, thank you.
We need fire-adapted forests.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think that this is a problem that also speaks to this moment where a lot of weird and radical ideas are being thought of. And so in that respect, I can appreciate what Lawrence Livermore Labs is trying to do, which is, you know, we have this climate crisis. So, and I agree with this fundamentally, that nothing should be off the table and we should give everything its consideration. This one, I think, just probably should have...
for about 5 seconds.
Yeah, it should have been considered for a little bit less time. You know, it was like somebody was smoking weed and they had this idea and like wrote it down in their dream journal and like somehow it ended up in a government report.
And they got paid for it.
And they got paid for it. I mean, I can smoke weed and come up with dumb ideas. Well.
I'll do that on the next show.
Yeah, yeah. The Green Gang gets high.
And we could talk about Summer Steelhead for a couple minutes if you guys want to.
And so Friends of the Eel has other things going on right now. You have some response from the feds on your petition to list Summer Steelhead. What's going on?
Well, a little over a year ago, we submitted petitions to both the state and the feds to list Summer Steelhead as a distinct species in the eel. Summer Steelhead are those awesome, really rare fish who are pre-migratory, so they come up into the watershed earlier than the other winter steelhead. They go into areas of the watershed that can't otherwise be reached, you know, in the winter times, and they're just really, really special and deserving of our protection. So we submitted petitions to have them listed, and the respective agencies did 12-month status reviews. We've now heard back from the feds that they are denying the listing, which we fully expected. What was a little bit surprising is that the Karuk tribe also submitted a listing petition for spring Chinook, which are similar in the way that they come into the watershed early, and they haven't heard back from their petition yet. So we're not quite sure about why that is.
Have you heard from the California Fish and Game Commission yet on your state petition?
We have not. I think that 12-month status review is possibly still underway. It works a little differently at the state and federal level. At the state level, they gave a preliminary okay. So as of now, those fish are listed unless they say otherwise. And we feel pretty confident about the state listing, much more so than we did about the federal one. So we've got 6 years to appeal it, which we definitely plan to. We're just now getting into the report and talking with the scientists and figuring out how we can get a little bit more research done. And we feel pretty hopeful about it.
All right. Well, good luck to Friends of the Eel on that one. And EPIC we have some experience, and we've always had a much fairer treatment before the California Fish and Game Commission than the feds. The feds have totally taken an anti-ESA position, especially now during the Trump administration. But, you know, even during the Obama reign, we were still having to deal with an agency that thought that they'd listed enough species already. So why are you continuing to add things to our list?
So, well, and a lot of these government agencies are just understaffed, underfunded, overwhelmed, and they just don't want more work. It's like the Regional Water Board, you know?
Yeah.
They seem to just be losing ground every year, and it's got to be pretty demoralizing.
I have some exciting news, which is the North Coast Regional Water Board just issued a permit to Green Diamond for the Elk River in particular concerning sediment pollution. And together with a similar permit that it issued to Humboldt Redwood Company, these two permits represent the most protective water quality protections for sediment pollution from timber that we have seen in California. So great on one hand. I anticipate that Green Diamond is going to sue to prevent this from ever actually being enforced against them. But, you know, we are slowly making progress in Elk River, which is one of our most historically degraded watersheds. So hopefully someday, you know, the Elk River residents won't be flooded out of their houses and that salmon will be able to come back and enjoy the Elk River in numbers that they once used to. All right.
Yeah. Well, good work.
No, oh, thanks. Well, that's our show. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Eco News Report. Join us again next week on this time and channel for more Eco News.